Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. We have one bill for public hearing. We have a number that are scheduled for work session. I am going to just put on the record at this point that SB 945 is being carried over. It will be carried over until this coming Monday, which I believe would be the 4th. Let's see what day we're on. Oh, it is. Today's the 6th.
Saturday is the 4th.
Okay.
April 6th.
So April 6th, Monday, April 6th for Senate Bill 945 for those who are interested in it. And then we have a couple other bills that are scheduled for work session that we do not have the paperwork, but I know that there are some interested parties that want to give comment specifically on Senate Bill 253. And what I'm going to try to do is work that in, but what I'm going to do is first start off with the public hearing, and then we'll come back because we're waiting for paperwork that may be ready before the end of the meeting on some of the other bills. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill, or Senate SJR 7, Senate Joint Resolution 7.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Joint Resolution 7 authorizes a constitutional amendment, a proposed amendment to the Constitution authorizing sobriety checkpoints for law enforcement purposes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. And we have a list of individuals who are going to be part of a panel type of approach. And what I'm going to do is, let's see, Senator Monroe, I'm going to have you come up, and I'm looking at who else is on the list. I'd like to have another chair brought up so we can have four people at the table. And
maybe Benita Howard might want to join us. She is the historian of traffic safety around here.
All right. Ms. Howard, if you'll come forward, and I'm going to go ahead and ask Chuck Hayes. And why don't we go ahead and have Chief Adams come up as well.
Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, I'm Rod Monroe, Senator from District 24 in East Portland and Happy Valley. Senate Joint Resolution 7 will allow the voters of the state of Oregon to determine whether or not law enforcement agencies should be allowed to use sobriety checkpoints to reduce the number of impaired drivers on our highways. The issue of sobriety checkpoints has never been voted on by the people of the state of Oregon. If the voters approve this measure, law enforcement agencies will have the discretion to use sobriety checkpoints. It's permissive, not mandatory. The 38 states that permit sobriety checkpoints have seen a 20% reduction in highway fatalities and serious injuries. This would mean at least 30 fewer deaths per year in Oregon and 2,100 fewer serious injuries. Imagine 150 or more fewer ER visits per month and the savings of millions of dollars to Oregon taxpayers and individuals in health care costs. When the issue has been polled, the vast majority of Oregonians support giving law enforcement agencies this tool. Sobriety checkpoints only delay motorists 2 or 3 minutes. The primary advantage of sobriety checkpoints over other kinds of police work is deterrent. This is why we see such a significant reduction in fatalities and serious injuries. They publish that there will be sobriety checkpoints, and people seem to take advantage of that and decide not to drink and drive. That's why you have such a significant reduction in those 38 states that currently use them. By the way, I just learned this morning that the Senate in Texas just approved sobriety checkpoints. It's now going over to the House. Sobriety checkpoints were conducted in Oregon prior to 1986. I actually spent a night on a sobriety checkpoint line in the city of Portland and talked to the people that were being stopped. And the people that were being stopped universally said, you know, I don't mind spending a minute or two if it means our streets are safer. A woman in Eugene was stopped at a sobriety checkpoint in 1982, and she sued and lost her case in the Lane County Circuit Court, but she appealed that to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals decided that Oregon Constitution was different than the U.S. Constitution, and that in fact sobriety checkpoints were not allowed. Since then, law enforcement agencies in Oregon over 20 years have not been allowed to conduct sobriety checkpoints. In 1990, a Michigan case was heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled that sobriety checkpoints were legal and constitutional. And in a recent case, in Indiana's Supreme Court ruled that sobriety checkpoints were legal. The reason the Indiana case is important is because Oregon's Constitution was word for word patterned after the Indiana Constitution, exact same wording with respect to search and seizure. Sobriety checkpoints are an important tool to keep our streets safe from dangerous impaired drivers. It's time for the voters of Oregon to decide whether they support sobriety checkpoints. Now, you also have, with my testimony, written testimony from John Moffitt, who's the head of NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. He wanted to come down today, but, you know, they don't have any money for out-of-state travel. Can't imagine that. And so, instead, he submits his testimony in writing, and I will not read it to you, but I would like to summarize a couple of the points that he makes. He says the primary responsibility for sobriety checkpoints is to reduce motor vehicle crashes and the related deaths, injuries, medical, and economic costs. He says that it's the most effective tool, the most effective type of high visibility enforcement. And he says that high visibility enforcement is much more likely than anything else to reduce drunk driving. And he says that sobriety checkpoints are by far the most effective high visibility enforcement. Based on documented studies, sobriety checkpoint program in Oregon, he says, would reduce alcohol-related fatalities by an estimated 20%, save 32 lives a year. And he also says that it's the policy of the National Highway Traffic Safety Commission to recommend that all states approve sobriety checkpoints and use them. They not only have the effect of detecting impaired drivers and being a strong deterrent, but also checkpoints allow the law enforcement people to find out which drivers are driving illegally with a suspended license, with no driver's license, with no insurance, etc. And he references a particular case where checkpoint program was conducted in the state of Tennessee over a two-year period, saw a 20% reduction compared to surrounding states. And during that same period of time, those surrounding states had an increase in drunk driving fatalities and injuries. Also, he states that sobriety checkpoints are a very efficient way to use police, that you can have a sobriety checkpoint with only four or six officers. They can move around. They're very mobile. And he again references the U.S. Supreme Court case that I mentioned in Michigan in 1990. Also, public support. NHTSA has taken public opinion surveys, and they've all indicated anywhere from a 70 to 80% public favor of sobriety checkpoints. Gallup did a poll for MAD, and I'm sure you'll hear more about, that showed 87% support for sobriety checkpoints. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think it's time. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to respond to questions before I go down and relieve my co-chair of the Ways and Means sub that I'm playing hooky from.
All right. We're going to go ahead and take questions. If you have any questions for Senator Monroe, so we can go on to his other task. Are there any questions? Senator, thank you very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
Appreciate the hearing.
And for the other three witnesses, whoever wants to go next, give us your name, please, and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Chuck Hayes. I'm the chair of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. I'm here representing our committee in response and support of Senate Joint Resolution 7. And I think that Senator Monroe has done an excellent job of providing testimony. In fact, gave some of the things that I was going to talk about. But I can tell you that we support sobriety checkpoints because we do believe, and we have seen, that they are a great tool
when it comes to the deterrence of impaired driving
and also in apprehending impaired drivers. I can tell you that in my career with the Oregon State Police, I worked 30 years for the Oregon State Police. I was promoted to sergeant and came to Salem in 1984. And in 1985, I actually conducted one of the first sobriety checkpoints ever held in this Marion County area. I took a team of seven troopers and we found a location that we thought would work well north of Salem. And prior to that, what we did is we advertised this through the media. We made sure that the radio, TV, and newspaper, everyone was aware that we were going to do a sobriety checkpoint that on a certain weekend. We didn't name whether it was a Friday or Saturday night. We did not give the location. We just said that there would be a sobriety checkpoint. We received at the Oregon State Police, I would say, literally hundreds of telephone calls from people wanting to know when and where the sobriety checkpoint was going to be. We also received a lot of telephone calls from people in support of the sobriety checkpoint. We started the checkpoint with seven troopers and myself, and we started at midnight. We intended to go till 3 o'clock in the morning. In 2 hours' time, we had to shut down the sobriety checkpoint because we had eight DUIs in custody. And what we also saw, and it was encouraging, is that we saw a lot of people that came through the sobriety checkpoint that morning that were had designated drivers. People that told us, we heard you were going to be here, so therefore I'm the designated non-drinking driver tonight. So that was very encouraging. We also had a lot of support from people who came through because in that 2 hours' time when we actually had to close up the checkpoint operation, we had a system in place that every fifth car that came through was the car that we would check. And so we stood by our system and we operated under those guidelines. And with the from what we saw with the media attention and then also, unfortunately, arresting people, but also getting the input from the people who came through, it was encouraging. And so we, from that point on, we continued to hold other sobriety checkpoints in the Salem area until, of course, the ruling came out that we could no longer do those. So from a standpoint of not only apprehension, but mainly from the standpoint of deterrence, we feel like that is one of the true measures of how important a sobriety checkpoint program is. We have looked at what other states do, and the state of Tennessee is a great example as to how they operate their sobriety checkpoints. They have policies in place, they have certain parameters, and they also involve the media. And so it is a highly publicized, high visibility type of enforcement effort that involves the media. So I think when we look at this, it's not just an apprehension tool, but it's also a huge deterrence tool. So we do support, the Governor's Advisory Committee does support this SJR-7, and we do believe that it should go to the vote of the public and get the public's opinion as to whether or not this could be a tool that could be used here in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. You bet. Thank you.
Chair Brzezinski, for the record, my name is Vanita Howard. I'm a member of the Governor's Advisory Committee on Driving Under the Influence of Intoxicants. 16 years ago, in a guest opinion for the Oregonian, I wrote that if the 1993 legislature wanted to take a step toward more efficient use of police resources, it should find a way to legalize sobriety checkpoints in Oregon. Well, that hasn't happened. They're still illegal here. And in the intervening years, our police manpower has decreased while our population and the number of vehicles and drivers on our roads have significantly increased. SJR 7 would at long last provide a way for the voters to have a say on the use of checkpoints on public streets and highways. Chuck has already mentioned the fact that, and so did the senator, that the Supreme Court has held that they are legal. 38 states now use them routinely, and that's another key feature, is that they are used frequently in these states, not just now and then. I like what the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court said when he said, the balance of the state's interest in preventing drunken driving, the extent to which this system can reasonably be said to advance that interest, and the degree of intrusion on individual motorists who are briefly stopped weighs in favor of the state program. We therefore hold that it is consistent with the Fourth Amendment. Literature reviews clearly show that checkpoints are associated with reductions of alcohol-related fatalities. And the value of those checkpoints goes, in my opinion, far beyond merely making arrests. The real value is that they deter the behavior itself. Checkpoints are not just about making arrests, they are about deterrence. And if we deter, we save not only the arrest and the inconvenience of going to jail, we save time in the courts, the prosecutors, in dealing with the thousands of drunk driving cases that we get each and every year. There was some excellent research conducted by the Institute, if I'm correctly identifying it, the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety by H. Lawrence Ross. I went into some detail in my written testimony in that. I won't spend the time to do it now. But he did again emphasize how important it is that these checkpoints be held routinely and that they be well publicized so that we can get people to stop engaging in that behavior. We have innumerable public opinion polls dating back to the 80s supporting checkpoints here in Oregon. The most recent one was in 2008, and even though we have not had an opportunity to have checkpoints in Oregon since that court decision, that survey in 2008 said that, let me just quote it, asked respondents to rate on a scale of 1 to 5 how effective they believe several actions would be in reducing the incidence of drunk driving in Oregon. And even though we haven't had them for more than 20 years here, 61% of those surveyed said they believe sobriety checkpoints would be effective or very effective in reducing the instances of drunk driving in Oregon. In other words, we think the public still supports sobriety checkpoints, and we think they would welcome an opportunity to voice that support in an election to amend our Constitution that clearly would authorize their use in this state. And therefore, we urge, as a part of the Governor's Committee, that your committee issue support for this particular House Senate joint resolution. That concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Mark.
Mr. Chair, committee, I'm Mark Adams, Chief of Police of the City of Keyser. I'm here representing the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, and I'll be short. They've said it. And we, the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, strongly support SJR 7. And my personal opinion, in 28 years of public safety in the state, the deterrent is what excites me about this. Now, there's a lot of folks who, right now will roll that dice and try to make it home. And I think this is just another big check in the don't do it box for them, this could be the thing that could prevent a tragedy. And we strongly support the resolution. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Questions for this, any other panel? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask Mr. Hayes, I'm trying to figure out how this actually works, and you said you had actually done one of these sobriety checkpoints, and you said that you stopped every fifth car. So what if you had some indication that, like, the third car or the fourth car, that there was somebody driving under the influence? I assume you would stop them as well?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonamici, yes. When we set up a sobriety checkpoint in the 80s, you would have a plan in place, and so you would get your all your officers together and say, okay, we're going to stop every fifth car as one that's going to be pulled out of line, and we'll check that, or every third. But yet, if you saw someone that came up into the checkpoint and did something that would give you probable cause to believe that you might have someone who is trying to avoid that line or maybe under the influence, then we would use the probable cause to actually then pull that car out. And so that has actually happened, because we've had people in the line that saw what was going on and have actually tried to turn and make a U-turn and almost caused a crash, and so we would then pull that car over. So we would use the probable cause if it was something outside of the parameters that we had established for pulling those cars out of line.
And of that, you said you had to close down because you already had eight people, and apparently that's all you could handle at that period of time with the staff that you had. Of those eight people, were those people who you would have had probable cause to pull over anyway?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonamici, all of those eight, and of course I'm going way back here, 1985, but all of those that we arrested were actually cars that were stopped or pulled out as a result of the procedure we had in place. So we don't know what was in between every fifth car that maybe we could have been missing. So other than just motioning those cars through, looking at the driver as they would go through, as they go through rather slowly. Now, if the troopers saw something in that car that would maybe make you think that you had an impaired driver or a crime, well, then again, we would use that probable cause to pull that person over, such as no seatbelt, or if you saw someone that maybe visibly looked intoxicated. But the majority, if not all of those, to my memory, were all arrested as a result of the procedure we had in place that night.
Thank you. And just one more, please. I'm trying to understand how this works. So when you pull over every fifth car, what happens? Does somebody do a breathalyzer, or just ask questions, or what happens to the... Because you said it only takes two or three minutes. So what is it that actually happens to every fifth car that gets pulled over?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonamici, every fifth car, then the trooper would ask for a driver's license, would talk to the individual as they're getting that driver's license and then showing us their registration. The officer would just be telling them, we're holding a sobriety checkpoint tonight and we're just checking to make sure the drivers are okay and we're not having any impaired drivers going through here tonight. So if they saw or observed nothing at that point that would be an indicator to them that that person was under the influence, driver's license and registration was returned and they were then right on through the line. So really, under most normal circumstances, you're only going to see about 1 to 2 minutes where they're going to be delayed, unless there is something there that would be an indicator to the officer to have that person then pull the car over and then actually conduct the further investigation.
Thank you.
Senator Wishart.
Thank you, Chair Pisaski. Is this a fair statement? If SJR 7 were to become state law, it would represent the first exception to Article 1, Section 9 of the Oregon Constitution that prohibits search and seizure without probable cause and without a court-ordered warrant.
Mr. Chair and Senator Whitsitt, I am not sure. That's not my area of expertise, so I would defer that to someone else, or I'll try to get that answer for you.
I'd appreciate that. It would seem to me that's what the Oregon Supreme Court determined, that the sobriety checkpoint was violated that probable cause and search without a warrant.
I believe you're correct, yes.
To follow up also, if you, you're not really just checking for sobriety, you're also checking your driver's license and registration insurance, and I assume if you had a dog there, you might also check to see if there were contraband drugs in the car, and you would also perhaps even check for citizenship papers. That be true?
Mr. Chair and Senator Whitsitt, the sobriety checkpoints that I was involved in the 80s, we did not utilize drug dogs. So now, do other states, that's a possibility that they may, and then the citizenship could be also something that could be part of that. But for the most part, when we were doing them in the 80s, we were focusing on impaired drivers and then also on, as you said, licensing violations, those kind of things.
And then one follow-up, then you would be asking for a driver's license and insurance and vehicle registration and so forth without any probable cause. It would simply be random.
Mr.
Chair, Senator Whitson.
That, again, would come back to how, if this was to be passed by the voters, well, then you would actually see, there would be a policy that would be developed here in the state of Oregon. And so under those policies, you could actually set those parameters if you chose to do that. So if it was the state police that was involved or the Chiefs Association, Sheriff's Association, all those other groups, well, then you could establish that, yes, through the policy.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for being here today. Our next panel is going to be Steve Dole, Barbara Sopler, Lois Harvick, and John Powell. And whoever would like to start off?
I guess I've been elected. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Steve Dole, President of Crime Victims United. In 1979, I had the experience of going through a sobriety checkpoint. And I remember it very specifically for a couple of reasons. I was at my parents' home in North Portland near the University of Portland. It was a couple of days before Christmas of that year. It was probably around between 7 and 8:30 in the evening, and I had my then 5-year-old son with me. We were driving back from my folks' house to my home in Lake Oswego. I remember a couple of things about it specifically, and that was, one, it really didn't feel like an intrusion of my rights. Two, it didn't take very long. And three, when I came through it, I felt when I drove away that it perhaps would save someone's life or save someone from being injured. And it was interesting that my 5-year-old son made a comment, and I think it was because he put two things together. He put together the issue of going through the checkpoint plus the fact that he'd heard me talk about an uncle who was a severe alcoholic who had passed away several years before that, and talk about an experience I once had with him when I was riding in his car when he was unfortunately drunk. And he said to me, "Dad," he says, "does this mean that somebody won't get hurt tonight?" And I says, "I think so." And you know, the studies bear that out, what we both felt when we went through the checkpoint that night. Sobriety checkpoints do save lives. In fact, in the 1990s, 8 studies were done on the effectiveness of 8 different sobriety checkpoint programs that the CDC found to be of high quality. All 8 found a significant decrease in the number of all crashes. Property damage crashes decreased between 24 and 35%. Crashes with injuries decreased between 5 and 23% with a median of 20%. And fatal crashes decreased between 20 and 26%. These studies were done in a mix of cities, counties, and states in both urban and rural areas. This research caused the Centers for Disease Control to conclude in 2002 that selective breath testing checkpoints reduce alcohol-related crashes, injuries, and fatalities. Now, I'll make 2 more points. You know, none of us like going through the checkpoints at the airport when we get on an airplane, but I think once we're on that airplane, we feel better.
But I haven't gone through that. I've been through numerous, I'm sure the committee have. I've even been through
one of their, if you will, super checks where they pull you off to the side and put you through even more rigorous checks. I don't necessarily like being shaken down when I have to go into a courthouse or a juvenile hall, take my belt off, take my shoes off, unload my pockets. But, you know, once I'm in there, I feel safer that nobody's going to take a shot at a judge or a district attorney or a defense attorney and I'm going to get hit. So we have those protections already built in, and, again, I don't feel like they're a violation of my rights. Last but not least, you know, sometimes within the criminal justice system, we give a lot of lip service to prevention. And I think this is as much a prevention bill as anything, because when one of these drivers is stopped, if in fact they are driving drunk, they're going to get a DUI and they're going to go to treatment. So we're preventing something from happening and we're treating all at the same time. And I thank you very much for your time and for hearing the bill.
Good morning. I'm Barbara Steffler, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I'm from Eugene, Oregon, founded the chapter of MAD in 1982 down there. We had, at that time, President Reagan, who was forming a task force on DUI and requested all the states in the nation to do so in their own states. Governor Attia put together a task force in Oregon with approximately 20 people. I was a member of that task force, and over the course of the year we met and heard testimony from the president's people on task force and DUI. What they told us is that there were many components for an effective an effective system to help the state of Oregon combat drunk driving or the nation. What the president did was sent his task force members around internationally to talk one-on-one with the safety people in different countries around the world. And so when they briefed us from time to time, one of the components was sobriety checkpoints that they recommended to us very strongly, because that would complete the control system that, when put in place, would do exactly what's been testified here today. We did at that time submit a sobriety checkpoint bill along with other bills, but the other bills were passed, which we were very grateful. And Senator Monroe, also at that time, was a sponsor behind those bills, and we thank him today for sponsoring this and bringing it back to the people of the state of Oregon. Down in Eugene, I don't know if you probably are aware that we've had some fairly severe tragic crashes lately. My experience down there has been that we deal with hundreds and hundreds of victim families. My other experience is that I helped create the Victim Impact Panel, which is a Lane County Victim Impact Panel, a separate entity from the courts, but we provide the service for the diversion program for the courts. We have probably had an attendance of drunk drivers of over 30,000 people since we founded it in 1990. We see over 100 every single month, and sometimes twice a month, from a 100 to 200. When you walk in to see the audience of the people that have been arrested, and those are just the ones that are coming then, probably half of the ones that need that have been ordered, you realize that we have more people out on our highways and streets that could hurt us than most people believe. I don't think they get it. The ones that are continually driving drunk, I think that the public is fed up, and I think they are ready to look at this issue and perhaps vote positively this time for the first time. They want to see something done. I appreciate your time, and thank you for hearing.
Thank you. Lois?
Good morning. My name is Lois Harvick with Mothers Against Drunk Driving from the Eugene Affiliate Office. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the members of the committee for holding this important hearing and for the opportunity to submit testimony to you today in support of Senate Joint Resolution 7, which is an important step to allowing for sobriety checkpoints in Oregon to occur. Drunk driving remains a 100% preventable violent crime that continues to create victims, kill, and injure innocent people. In Oregon in 2007, 150 people were killed in drunk driving crashes. These needless deaths accounted for 33% of all total traffic fatalities in Oregon. The good news is that we can finally put an end to drunk driving forever. In November of 2006, MAD launched its campaign to eliminate drunk driving with the goal of doing just that. Included in this campaign is support for intensive, highly visible law enforcement activities, including twice yearly crackdowns and frequent enforcement efforts that include sobriety checkpoints and saturation patrols in all 50 states. I come here today on behalf of Mothers Against Drunk Driving to discuss this important component in MAD's campaign to eliminate drunk driving. Sobriety checkpoints are not roadblocks. They are a very simple law enforcement tool. Sobriety checkpoints evaluate drivers for signs of alcohol or drug impairment. Vehicles are stopped in a specific sequence, for example, every third or fifth vehicle. Vehicles are not chosen irregularly. Vehicles are not stopped based on the vehicle type. Vehicles are not stopped based on the ethnicity of the driver or who is riding in the vehicle. When conducted properly, sobriety checkpoints cause a delay between 30 seconds and about the length of stopping for a red light, a minor inconvenience when compared to the lives saved. In fact, law enforcement officials across the country report that the number one thing said at a checkpoint is, "Have a nice day." Despite this minor inconvenience for drivers, the United States Supreme Court ruled that sobriety checkpoints are constitutional because this small inconvenience was overwhelmed by the compelling state interest in saving lives. Some may say that saturation patrols, which Oregon currently uses, are good enough. Unfortunately, while saturation patrols are good as far as they go, sobriety checkpoints have a much stronger general deterrent effect. They prevent people from ever committing the crime. Mothers Against Drunk Driving encourages this committee to pass Senate Joint Resolution 7 and also to consider Senate Bill 352. Senate Bill 352 would specify that if checkpoints are legalized and approved by voters, the state must follow the National Highway Traffic Safety Guidelines. Sobriety checkpoints are an option that should be available to law enforcement in an effort to prevent drunk driving from occurring. Thus, Mothers Against Drunk Driving strongly supports Senate Joint Resolution 7. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm John Powell, representing the 36 Oregon County Sheriffs, in support of SJR 7. Mr. Chairman, I would just say we appreciate you taking time to hear this, and it's interesting to be part of a hearing where there is no special interest who's going to make money off this bill or somebody fighting it because they may lose money. It's a broad public policy question of great importance, and we appreciate you taking time to listen about this important subject. It's also an issue I could argue either side of, and it's a tough question, and we know that. It's an issue that we know, if it passed the voters, you would likely face legislation to put parameters on law enforcement's use of this tool. But it is a very, very important tool. Overconsumption of alcohol is becoming a major problem. When my children were smaller, we would buy a package of 8 tickets to the local baseball park out here for when professional baseball first came to Salem. And we had the same seats each game. And there was a business that had like 8 seats in front of us. And these people consumed alcohol before the game, during the game, and a 9-inning game, they would cut you off at the 7th inning. And by the end of the 7th inning, each person had 3 or 4 full beers underneath their seat so they could continue to consume through the 9th inning. And then they would go get in their automobiles. And I think sobriety checkpoints would affect those types of people. They would know that there was a chance that when they left that ballpark, there could be somebody checking for sobriety. So I do think it would have an impact, a silent impact, far beyond just catching some people behind the wheel while intoxicated. So we would support giving the people an opportunity to vote on this constitutional amendment.
Thank you. Any questions?
Steve?
Is this a question?
It is.
You may not get a response.
It is not, Mr. Chair. I wondered if I could, however, try to answer in a non-lawyerly manner a question that Senator Witz had of the panel just before us.
If you'd like.
I will attempt to. I was talking to Bradbury in the back of the room, and it's this issue of Article 9, the search and seizure laws in Oregon. The Oregon Constitution in that area has always more or less mimicked the U.S. Constitution. And in Indiana has the exact same phrasing in their Constitution. Our Constitution was lifted from theirs. They allow checkpoints. The reason we don't allow them here, I believe, is because our Constitution was interpreted in the early 80s by Justice Lindy to provide broader protections for Oregonians in the areas of search and seizure than even the United States Constitution. So, thank you.
Thank you very much for being here. The last two people I have scheduled on the registration for testimony today is Dave Fedanke and Bob Holman. Why don't you come forward? And while they're coming up, was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony that did not get on the sign-up sheet? Dave, Bob, we're going to start.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. David Fedanke, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon. And for those of you who don't know me or haven't heard this particular testimony in prior sessions, I began working for the ACLU in 1982. And the case of Nelson versus Lane County that Senator Monroe referred to earlier was a case that I was involved with from the very beginning, because that case started in December of 1982 after the day after the first sobriety checkpoints in Oregon took place. And we had contacted the media in advance of those roadblocks to let the media know that we felt they were unconstitutional and that we'd be very interested in talking to anyone who was stopped who was sober. And that next morning, I got a phone call from Linda Nelson, who was an employee of the city of Eugene, but resided in Marcola, which, Mr. Chair, you know, is well outside the city limits of Eugene. She commuted to and from work every day. And that previous evening, she had actually been at the mayor's Christmas party because she worked in the city manager's office. And she was on her way home well after dinner. She was sober. And she and her boyfriend were driving east on Highway 126 behind a car that was weaving all over the road. And they were very upset about that. They breathed a big sigh of relief when they got off the freeway at the 42nd Street exit in Springfield because they weren't going to have to be anywhere near that drunk driver. Within 30 seconds, they came upon the sobriety checkpoint, and they were stopped. That drunk driver got off scot-free that evening because every police officer who was on duty that evening for the Lane County Sheriff and the Oregon State Police were at the sobriety checkpoint. And as was similar to what you've heard the previous witnesses testify to, in fact, they were stopping periodically vehicles that came up to the roadblock, letting the others pass through. Ms. Nelson's car was one of those who was stopped. And the trooper leaned into her car and asked her if she'd been drinking. And her boyfriend said, "She's not the one who's been drinking." And meaning the guy who was driving the other car that they'd been following earlier was the one who'd been drinking. So they were very upset. As things turned out, Ms. Nelson was pulled over and asked to do field sobriety tests, which she passed with flying colors, even in high heels, standing on a gravel grade. She was able to get through all that. and she went on her way that evening, but she was very angry because she felt that the sobriety checkpoint was not an effective way to catch drunk drivers. And in fact, in the intervening years, many of the same studies have been cited by other witnesses have also shown that saturation police patrols are much more effective at finding and arresting drunk drivers. And in fact, Oregon law enforcement agencies have engaged in saturation patrols over the last 22 years here in Oregon, and they've been very effective. Other things that Oregon has done have been very effective. We were one of the first states to lower the blood alcohol percentage to 0.08. Now that's the standard nationwide. Again, we were one of the first states to lower the blood alcohol level for minors to zero. And that has been very effective. Have we eliminated drunk driving? No. I agree with MAD's goal of trying to eliminate drunk driving, but I think we should do it in the most cost-effective and effective ways that are at our disposal. And long-term, I think the only way you're going to eliminate drunk driving is to have effective ignition interlock devices in every vehicle so that people who've been drinking and whose blood alcohol level is over the limit cannot start their vehicles and cannot drive. Until we have that in place, there will be people driving who are over the limit. The question is, how can we best find those people and get them into the criminal justice system so they don't do it again? One of the other things that you need to know, I think, today in evaluating this proposed constitutional amendment is that the decision by the Oregon Supreme Court interpreting Article 1, Section 9 does not prohibit sobriety checkpoints in Oregon. All that opinion said is that you cannot use random stops without any suspicion in order to arrest people for a crime. You can do random checks. You can do complete checks at airports and public buildings of everyone who comes in the door. You just can't prosecute them for a crime if you're doing those kinds of random searches. And so what the Oregon Supreme Court said was, you could, if the legislature authorized sobriety checkpoints, you could do them, but the consequence would have to be civil in nature or administrative, not criminal. Now, I don't support those kinds of sobriety checkpoints, frankly, because I think drunk drivers should be arrested and should be prosecuted. But I think it's important for you to understand that sobriety checkpoints are not unconstitutional under all circumstances in Oregon. And finally, Mr. Chair, if I could respond to Senator Whitsitt's question. I'm not an attorney, but I am a student of the Constitution. This indeed would be the first, if it were to be approved by the voters, the first successful amendment of the Oregon Search and Seizure Clause. But it is not the first to attempt an amendment. There was a proposal that was put forward in the late 90s that would have amended the Oregon Search and Seizure Clause to make it identical to the federal Fourth Amendment. And that amendment was rejected by this legislature, and I think wisely so, as have previous versions of this proposal in front of you today. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Chair Przonski, members of the committee, my name is Bob Holman. I am a criminal defense practitioner and have been solely that for the last 25 years. Article 1, Section 9 prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures to all of the citizens of the state of Oregon. This provision was enacted in 1859 and has remained unchanged. Again, to answer Senator Whitsitt's question. Over the years, statutes have been enacted prescribing boundaries for law enforcement officers to comply with these constitutional guarantees. Article 1, Section 9 has also been subject to interpretation many times by the Oregon Supreme Court and the Oregon Court of Appeals. By constitutional interpretation, it is clear that the intent of Article 1, Section 9 is to protect the privacy rights of its citizens. But those protections are not without restrictions. Officers have the right to stop vehicles when the operator has committed a traffic infraction in the officer's presence. They can investigate the violation. They may conduct pretext stops. That means they can stop a vehicle for a violation when the real reason for the stop is to investigate other suspicions. This applies to DUI investigations as well as other traffic stops. Officers currently have the right to stop a person or a vehicle when they have probable cause to believe the crime has been committed or is about to be committed. If the stopped vehicle can be driven off by some person present, officers are allowed to search that vehicle if they have probable cause to believe the vehicle contains evidence of some crime. If the stopped vehicle is impounded, for instance, if the driver's license is suspended, he doesn't have a license, or the vehicle is illegally parked, the officers have a right to inventory the contents of the vehicle. But in each of these situations, the officer must have an articulated reason for the stop. Under the suggested amendment to Article 1, Section 9, there need be no articulated reason to stop a vehicle at a sobriety checkpoint. In fact, as written, it appears that the language of this provision would allow pedestrians to be stopped because it's not limited to vehicles. And if Article 1, Section 9 does not apply to Oregon or to sobriety checkpoints, what is the officer going to be allowed to do? If this amendment is enacted, can the officer detain an individual without reasonable suspicion? Can the officer arrest a person without probable cause? Can the officer search the vehicle without probable cause or any exigency? It's not clear. Can dogs be used to conduct an investigation of the vehicle or an occupant of the vehicle? This attempt to amend the Constitution is fraught with peril. There are no standards to inform an officer what he or she is allowed to do at a checkpoint. There are no reasonable time, place, duration limitations. Without such limitations, Oregonians may be stopped and detained for hours for no apparent reason, and their individual privacy will be subjected to scrutiny. I believe that if this is enacted, there could be hundreds and hundreds of different policies in the state of Oregon that are all different. Without some sort of standardization up front, we don't know what is going to happen if the people of the state of Oregon approve this proposition. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions?
Quick question.
Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask, David, you mentioned something about saturation patrols, and we've been given some information that sobriety checkpoints are more effective at deterring driving under the influence than saturation patrols, and you suggested the opposite. And I wonder, do we just have dueling studies, and if so, do you have a study or something that we could look at?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bonamici, I'm looking at a recent article from the Kansas City Star, which cited results of numerous sobriety checkpoints and saturation patrols in the Kansas City area over the previous few years. And I'll just read from the article, if I may. Five of the larger area police departments stopped 25,510 vehicles at checkpoints last year, but only 2,765 during saturation patrols. The total arrest rate for the sobriety checkpoints was 2.8%, but out of the saturation patrol stops, there were more citations and arrests than there were stops. The cost of the saturation patrols was $31.68 per ticket or arrest, and the cost of the checkpoint price tag per ticket or arrest was $184.84. And most of the studies that have been done related to sobriety checkpoints look at the effects post-sobriety checkpoints and focus on the deterrent effect of the checkpoints. But not very many of those studies look at the other things that were done during the same time frame to reduce drunk driving. And, I guess I would ask, why is it that there is more media attention of sobriety checkpoints than there is of saturation patrols? I think the answer is, having been a former TV reporter myself, is that you can go to a sobriety checkpoint and get a minute's worth of film that you can use on that evening's news in a minute. But to get a minute's worth of video from a saturation patrol, you have to ride along on that saturation patrol, and it could take several hours. However, I think the media coverage from saturation patrols can be just as effective, if not more effective, in educating the public if they're done right and with the cooperation of broadcast media and other news media outlets. And there's no reason why it shouldn't be.
Thank you.
Any other questions, comments? I do want to put on the record, someone has passed me a note saying that they disagree with Mr. Pedanke's testimony regarding the Article 9, that people overwhelmingly passed Measure 40 back in 1996. So I'm not asking for a counterpoint, so I'm not going to have another person come up. But that is something that was going to be put on the record as to whether that was,
Yes, and Ms. Chair, as you, I'm sure, recall, ballot measure 40 was overturned because it contained multiple constitutional amendments by the Oregon Supreme Court, and the legislature in 1999 agreed to split that up into eight different measures. Eight of those measures were approved by the House, but one was rejected by the Senate. And the one that was rejected by the Senate was the one that would have amended Article 1, Section 9 to make it identical to the Fourth Amendment in its interpretation. The other seven measures were put on the ballot. Four were approved by the voters, and three were rejected.
Thank you very much. Y'all are excused. Thank you. But what I want to do is I looked at the list that I have for witnesses and Ann Pratt, and you're listed on Senator Monroe's list. And I know that you handed in written testimony. You weren't on the other list. So I'm assuming that your written testimony was all you wanted to do. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. Then the other thing is Nina Ryerson, who's with the Department of Justice. I don't know if there's anything else that you would like to put on the record. And I understand maybe Brad, Barry, if you all want to come up and put something else on the record, I'll let you do that for the purpose of maybe trying to clarify whatever has or hasn't happened by the voters over the years as it pertains to Article 9 of the Constitution. That's right. I want to make sure we narrow the scope here.
Sure. For the record, I am Bradbury, Yamhill County District Attorney, and I chair the Oregon District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee. I had not intended to testify this morning. In fact, I didn't know I was coming over this morning until this morning, so I didn't prepare extensively about this. Just a couple of comments that I might make, Chair, related to the kind of search issues that you're asking us to comment on. First, it is accurate that the Oregon Constitution, in how it deals with search, does differ in its language from the U.S. Constitution and has been more broadly interpreted by the Oregon Supreme Court. That is accurate. However, it doesn't change the fact that what we're looking at is both constitutions prohibit unreasonable searches and seizures. And the discussion about the U.S. Supreme Court decision was one where it actually states quite unequivocally that the minor intrusion into the public on a search related to a checkpoint is far outweighed by the dangers of driving under the influence of intoxicants. So it's a weighing test that the U.S. Supreme Court used, and candidly, the Oregon Supreme Court differed in their interpretation of that by prohibiting sobriety checkpoints. If I might, and I'll ask Chair Przanski, if I just address a couple of real brief issues of saturation versus sobriety checkpoints that were made by your last presenters. I don't want to go beyond what you're asking me to present.
All right. Very briefly, we have the work sessions. I think you're here on one of them, and we need to make sure we cover those as well.
I am. Thank you, Chair. I did want to mention that checkpoints, by their mere nature and as they've been approved, are extremely limited intrusions into the public's interest against unlawful searches, and they are by design brief, they are by design random, and it is only once a person who has been stopped at the checkpoint and where reasonable suspicion to explore further occurs and where probable cause is developed could somebody be arrested. I think there was a statement made that you could have somebody arrested on reasonable suspicion. That's just not accurate. The officer would have to develop probable cause. Additionally, and I suppose lastly, in the attempt to be brief, sobriety checkpoints has the ability to stop briefly many people, quick check, let them go on their way. Saturation patrols don't have that. You have officers patrolling miles and miles and miles and miles before they would ostensibly find someone who commits some traffic violation they would stop them for. You certainly do not have the coverage that is there, and you have a law enforcement investment that is quite significantly greater with saturation patrols than you do with sobriety checkpoints.
All right. Dina, did you have anything you need to add?
No, thank you, Senator Przanski. My name is Dina Ryerson. I work for the Department of Justice. I'm the DUI resource prosecutor for Oregon. And if anybody is in need of any studies, the National Traffic Law Center, I work with them. I can give you any studies you need relating to sobriety checkpoints. They have an extensive file. And I know that Oregon's one of the few states that don't have sobriety checkpoints, so that they do have extensive studies on the states who do have them. So if anyone is in need of those studies, I can provide them.
All right, thank you. Any questions? Senator Boquist.
Mr. Anita, counsel or counsel, because we've only had a couple of lawyers up here. Which came first, the Supreme Court ruling or the state Supreme ruling, state court ruling?
Want to say that again now?
Referring to the Supreme Court has ruled that they're okay to do.
Oh, the U.S. Supreme
Court?
The U.S. Supreme
Court says they're okay to do, and the state has an opinion or something that the justice said.
That was prior to...
Chair Przanski, Senator Boquist, that's my recollection. Again, not having taken the time to go back through these cases before coming before you, was my recollection the U.S. Supreme Court authorizing sobriety checkpoints under the United States Constitution. That decision did predate the Oregon Supreme Court decision stating that they were unlawful under the Oregon Constitution.
Thank you.
Yeah. We're watching the room to see if everyone's agreeing to this.
We'll
leave this.
What was the date on that?
It's in the testimony.
It's 1987 for Oregon.
1987 is Oregon. And then Ms. Howard's testimony says 3 years after the Oregon court decision, the United States Supreme Court ruled.
Okay. Again, I didn't have a chance to check that in state record.
Then we stand corrected. All right. Thank you all very much. All right. So I'm going to go ahead and close the hearing on SJR 7. And we're going to stay at ease just for a second because we need to figure out what we have available at this point if we're going to move anything on the work sessions.
Fine.
1990.
Six. And then the other question, the ones that we have, I'm not sure if we got the paperwork back. And Brad, you told me, if I got this correct, you might want to give some comment if we were able to hear that today on Senate Bill 253.
Yes.
All right, so what I'm going to go ahead and do is open up a work session on 253. And the purpose of this work session is to allow Brad Berry to put some comments on the record since he wasn't here for the public hearing, and let you know that we're still waiting for paperwork, so we're not moving it today.
I understand that. Again, for the record, I am Brad Berry, Yamhill County District Attorney, and I chair the ODAA Legislative Committee. Chair Przanski, when we were talking before the hearing, I know you wanted me to limit comments, I think, to the dash two amendments.
Well, the dash twos is really what's before us, and that's what we heard yesterday, and we left it that we're going to leave that open to give members an opportunity to absorb what was there, and I understand that you had some comments that you wanted to make regarding that, because that's kind of what we're looking at right now.
Again, from I think it's been clear that the Oregon District Attorneys Association has taken the position that really this entire concept is a solution in search of a problem. We're unaware of any cases that have even been presented by the proponents which would indicate we have a problem related to confessions and the like. I might also point out that that as it stands, statements by a defendant to a layperson would be admitted, where statements to a law enforcement officer trained to, in fact, be exact about what they hear and relate it to juries, for example, would fall under different standards as this is, with the custodial interrogation limitations requiring recordation of the veil versus just statements otherwise to a layperson. And I think that's important to note. We certainly agree that recordation is ideal. That's not a misstatement, and recordation works, but to if it fails to occur, then to have an instruction to a jury which is negative by the court is the sanction that we don't think is appropriate. I suppose lastly I would point out that the National District Attorneys Association 2 weeks ago actually had a spirited debate about this particular subject, and in fact ultimately created a resolution which I'm happy to discuss further. This might not be the time, where in fact it provides a carrot for law enforcement to record statements, admissions, confessions by suspects or defendants, a reward system, so to speak, rather than a stick, which this would be, which is a sanctioning prohibition by an instruction to the jury. As to the dash two amendments, if I might, just a couple of comments to those. I've looked at it. I think I understand the changes that the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association is proposing there. I did have a question related to page 3, section 3, wherein there are the comments there related to the juvenile proceedings. You'll note under section 3, paragraph 1, it seems to limit those to 419C270 actions. And then it goes down to talk about basically non-English-speaking interviews. And as I read it and as it's currently stated, it appears that the other good cause exceptions listed for adult interrogations would not apply. Now, that I may be misreading it. It may be unintentional, but it does specifically talk about non-native speaking, and then it says or rather than and, going to section C, which then talks about the good cause exception. So I don't know if that was an unintended consequence of this particular amendment or not, but that at least is a reading, my reading as I went through it this morning, that caused me some concern. Again, I think Mr. Neely has had some contact, was providing additional information related to the National DA's Association proposal to the committee. I'd like to have the opportunity to have at least some discussion related to the incentive approach rather than the punishment approach. And the other thing I think I mentioned to you, Chair Przanski, is that we'd further like to have some consideration, if the committee is inclined to move this bill, to talk about removing the two-party consent rule for law enforcement interrogations and make it a one-party consent rule.
All right. Fair enough. As to statements, Senator Wissett.
Yes, thank you. Chair Przanski, I wanted to get into that one-party consent. Some of the proponents of this measure have suggested that other states are using it, and it works well. And it's come to my attention that most, if not all, of those states are one-party consent states, where the law enforcement officer can, in fact, have the recording device in his pocket and not tell the individual that's being recorded that they are being recorded. Is that a fair statement?
Chair Przanski, Senator Whitsitt, it is my understanding that all, or maybe with one exception, of the states that currently require recordation are one-party consent states. I will tell you, before when this bill came up originally, I did a lot of review of the various states and got information for those who did come and testify about how many states required recordation, how many considered it, and the like. Many of those numbers that you probably heard at the prior testimony came from a survey I had done. I did not specifically ask that question, but since that time, I have been told that there may be just one of those states is a non-one-party consent state. But I think you're correct. Most, if not all, are one-party consent. Thus, the officer doesn't have to say, I'm recording our conversation and put the tape recorder out in front of a suspect, which, as you might well guess, is a very chilling effect on a suspect with candidly answering questions to law enforcement.
As it is with a reporter.
Yes.
Experience.
Yes. Okay, so this is where we're at. I wanted to give Mr. Berry the opportunity to put some stuff on the record. The chair is planning on having a little meeting with the interested parties so we can kind of see where we're at. I do know, and I do want to also put on the record, that Mr. Neely was participating at some level with the proponents of the bill and giving suggestions. And my understanding that proponents did accept most of those, if not all of those. But we're at a point where we're going to see if we can, let's say, iron out any wrinkles that we may have. Is the intent of the chair that something in some level is going to be moving forward, if I have the support within this committee to address some of this area. That's not saying where, but it's something that at least there's one area that my discussions with some of the members, we think that we need to have some other verification as to what might be said in these type of situations. So with that, is there, yes?
The question that I would really like to have clarified on the record is whether is the one-party consent or the two-party consent thing. It's a seminal question, actually.
Yeah, so I mean, that's going to be something that we will definitely be looking at. I think there's some validity as to if we're looking at going this way, knowing what has been used in other parts of the country and what is, you know, and what would give the most safeguards and understanding, and also looking at the policy issues, because if you're going to have this that type of exception, currently it is against the law to do a face-to-face interview or discussion with someone without both parties knowing. And so that is one of those areas that we have, you know, a little tidbit difference. If you can do it on the telephone, there's one-party consent, but you can't do one-party consent currently in our state. And I know we've looked at other issues around video cameras and capturing the recording of the voice as well as the images. All right, so with that, I'm going to go ahead and close the work session that we have right now on Senate Bill 253. And I'm looking at two councils because I know we have some stuff that's ready to move. And so tell me which one we have so we can do it.
Senate Bill 157 we can move, and Senate Bill 66 we can move.
All right, so I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill 157. And whoever's counsel on that?
I am counsel on that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 157 was from the Employment Department of Human Services to require fingerprints for criminal background checks for those providing services as a contractor, subcontractor, vendor, or volunteer. We heard this on February 3rd. We have a Dash 1 amendment that they worked with the ACLU on that limits the criminal background check to those workers who have access to sensitive information or provide care. This one has no revenue impact. It has a fiscal statement that was received that's on your desk right now. DHS said there's no fiscal. Employment Department said there's a minimal. And the Oregon State Police said minimal, but concerns about the cumulative impact of these fingerprint background checks. So it is ready to move if the committee so chooses.
All right. So I will take a motion on Senate Bill 157.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 into 157.
Senator Boquist moves the dash ones into Senate Bill 157. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Chair, I move SB 157 as amended by the dash one to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 157 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And let's see. Senator Boquist, I carried one for you earlier on this topic, so I'll let you do this one.
My turn.
I'll take two
in a row, Mr. Chair. No, that's guys happy.
That one worked. All right. And then that closes the work session on Senate Bill 157. And we'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 66.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 66 is from the Department of Education. We heard this on March 2nd. It allows the Department of Education to conduct criminal records checks for potential employees. This is consistent with the executive order they already have. We have a dash one amendment that removes the emergency clause that was in the bill originally, and it requires the agency to use regular rulemaking and not emergency rulemaking on this issue.
All right. So this is kind of, I guess, our trilogy of these type of checks. This is at least the third, not the fourth one we've had this session.
Mr. Chair, I don't have a fiscal on this.
We have a minimal. We have a dash one minimal fiscal.
Okay. So just a question about that, because on the previous bill we had sort of a written statement.
Right.
We don't have a written statement.
No, the minimal fiscals don't have statements that come with them. They just say minimal. So we have no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal on the dash.
Mr. Chair, move the dash one into SB 66.
Senator Boquist moves the dash ones into Senate Bill 66. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, move SB 66 to the floor with the dash one. Do pass.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 66 with the dash one amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And
Mr. Chair, I'll take that.
Okay, if you'd like, we'll
hopefully both right in a row. If they exactly the same.
They should be hopefully
standing up.
That's right.
We'll do our best to see if we can't get those in order. So Boquist will be the carrier on both those bills. Now, what I want to do is put on the record where we're at on these others. As I've already mentioned, Senate Bill 945 is carried over until this Monday, the 4th, April 6th, I should say. The next bill, Senate Bill 385, we will carry that over to Monday, April 6th.
Chairman of the committee, we have the fiscal and the revenue.
Oh, do we?
We do.
That's right.
Although, Chairman of the committee, though it does not have a prior referral to Ways and Means Committee, it needs one. The fiscal statement should be in your packet. It's around $10 million.
Okay, so
we can go ahead and move that one.
We could move it with an amendment. All right.
Chairman of the committee, we've already
ready. The
amendment has already been done, so what we need now is the motion to move it from the committee with the due pass recommendation to Ways and Means. Senator Boquist?
We've already put the dash three in.
Mm-hmm.
We have.
Are we in work session?
We'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 385.
Mr. Chair, I move SB 385 to the Ways and Means Committee with a...
Yeah.
Right, exactly what she just said.
All right, Senator Boquist moves that
Ways and Means.
Senate Bill 385 be moved with a due pass recommendation to the floor with a subsequent request for a referral to Ways and Means. Okay. Any discussions?
Yes.
Senator Wissett, first, and then we're going to come back.
I'm not going to support this today. I may reverse myself on the floor, but I need some more information about whether how this may have a detrimental effect on funding for drug courts, mental health courts, and also with the Burns funds that are coming down, some $22 million in Burns funds are coming down to what a large part of that would be supplied to the Major 57 drug treatment. And I need some clarification on whether this is separate money or the same money.
I understand. And that's one of the reasons that we're moving into Ways and Means, because there's going to be a discussion starting tonight, I think, on some of these issues as to what is the priority for moving forward. Senator Boquist.
And Mr. Chair, I'm for the same reason, the opposite direction. I'm supporting this to send it downstairs, and if it turns out the fiscal doesn't long-term save money, then I may reverse myself.
And I would tell everyone that no one's on the hook for the floor until we know what's coming out of Ways and Means, because I think there's many priorities that we need to balance and before we are fully committed, but this is a means for that to occur.
And I just want to make the same statement Senator Boakless made.
All right.
What he said.
All right, so ditto. And any other comments? Any objection? So ordered. All right, so the last ones that we have still sitting here, we have Senate Bill 253. Now, this is the one that we just took some more testimony on. What I'm going to do is carry this one over, and I'm going to carry it over until Wednesday, April 8th. So that will give us enough time for me to be able to meet with the parties on that. So that's carried over until Wednesday, April 8th. And then on Senate Bill 306, that one there needs a little bit more work, and I'm going to go ahead and set that one.
And Mr. Chair, that one was actually taken off the agenda on the revision number 4.
So it is?
It's not on.
Okay. So that we will not deal with. Is there anything else, Council? Oh, there is one thing for members. In this morning's meeting with the Chair for the House Judiciary, what we are going to be asking members to do is to alert our staff. If you have amendments for any bills that are coming forward, to give them notice as soon as possible, because we're getting that crunch point where we have to have the workup of the paperwork done. And we're going to reach a point where if we don't have enough notice to get that work done, the amendments will not be entertained, and you will have to take it up on the other side of the building for a Senate bill so we can make sure we stay to schedule. We will be getting much, much tighter in time, but hopefully first of next week we can kind of go over a few more things just to make certain the last week and a half, 2 weeks of Senate bills, we're all on the same page. Anything else? Thank you very much, and we're adjourned till Monday.